We have all been in the grip of a worldwide virus that has taken a toll on our world's population as well as on our own emotions during the period in which it has been going on now for months. It's been a very unusual experience for us because we have been totally out of control. We're unable to stop it on our own. We're unable to change the course of it. And we are unable to predict where it is going and how long it will last or how treacherous it will become. We hear others tell of that. Often they are wrong. Sometimes they are right on target. I'm sure many of them are sincere as they attempt to guide us through this time of COVID-19. We are hoping to learn in the process some things that God would teach us. You may recall my mentioning the words of Malcolm Muggeridge in the message last time we were together. He said, any happening, great or small, is a parable whereby God speaks to us. And the art of life is to get the message. So that would include our time as well. During this period, that's impossible to get our arms around. It is like a parable where God is speaking to his children, you and me alike. It's essential that we slow our pace, quiet our lives long enough to get his message, because he does not shout. He will not race to catch up. We must slow our pace so that we might get in step with him and hear what he's saying, which caused me to speak last time on the priority of solitude. We cannot get God's message in the din and noise of the marketplace. It requires time alone, time to think, time to search ourselves and learn some things about ourselves, and in the process, more importantly, some things about our God. Today I want to address the necessity of humility. May seem to be strange bedfellows, solitude and humility, but they are not at all. In many ways, they are twins. Certainly during the time of the virus, we have come to realize how helpless we are, how unable we are to throw a switch or take a pill or get a shot or get the counsel of someone very wise, very smart, who will get us beyond it. We can do none of those things. We are, considering all things, we are at the mercy of our times. That, if nothing else, will begin to help us realize the value of humility. All of this ties in with the way we do what we do as believers. When someone asks me what I do, and we've never met before, I tell them I'm involved in the Lord's work. That's usually a general way to answer the question. I don't talk about pastoring a church. I don't talk about my past and the things I've done. I simply say I'm involved in the Lord's work. Most people get that. But there's so much more to what we do. You are also involved in the Lord's work. It was back in 1974, I had the privilege of meeting and hearing Dr. Francis Schaeffer, a name from the past some of you will readily remember, others of you may not know of. Dr. Schaeffer sort of took the Christian world by storm. He lived in La Brie, Switzerland, and began to emerge as one of those on whose life God's hand rested, and God spoke through him. Some of his books were deep and difficult to grasp. The God Who Was There was one of his first. And those who love philosophy loved following the teachings of Dr. Schaeffer. But he got right down into the nuts and bolts of life. And by the time he was continuing his ministry of writing, he began to write on such things as No Little People or True Spirituality and such works as that. I found myself taken by the man back in 74. He had come to Dallas Seminary to speak, and I attended the sessions where he was teaching, and it was through him I learned a statement I've never forgotten. It was embedded in my brain. Just 10 words that I hope you will hear today and learn and repeat enough for them to become a part of your thinking from here on out. We must do the Lord's work in the Lord's way. I'm not saying that's an original statement with Schaeffer, but that was the first time it rang the bell in my mind, making a lot of sense. Back in 74, the jury was still out in my life, and I was searching quite a bit for direction I should take and where the Lord was leading me in my ministry. And I had many years to go, had no idea what God was going to do, but I loved the way that came across. Not only do I want to do the Lord's work, and I want us to do the Lord's work, we want to do it in the Lord's way. All of us have ability, all of us have strengths, but the fact is that if we operate in the Lord's work apart from Christ, we are operating in the energy of our own flesh. And there's a lot of that energy available. We've all done that, and we've all regretted it. I've lived long enough to know the value of doing it in the power of Christ. He said, that is, Jesus said, apart from me, you can do nothing, meaning nothing worthwhile, nothing that will be rewarded, nothing that will make a lasting impact. So to do the Lord's work and the Lord's way means we must operate as Christ operated. We must live a life as Christ lived. We must conduct ourselves as Christ conducted himself, and we're able to do that because of the indwelling presence of the Spirit of God that exists within us to carry out that message. When we came to Christ, the Spirit of God took up his residence within us and immediately began working within us to carry out the Lord's work, the Lord's way. The more I study Christ, and it's been a lifetime of study, the more one characteristic stands out above all the others. And there were many that were magnificent about the ministry and life of Christ. But the one that stands out and that must have impacted his times more than any other, in my opinion, is his humility. Think of it. He came from the very presence of the Father, from the throne room of God. He descended and came to this earth as a human being, became a human being, and even in the passage in Philippians 2, he humbled himself and became obedient unto death, even death on a cross. Right away, we read the word humbled. He humbled himself. My Bible is open to Philippians 2. I'd like to direct your attention there. We'll work our way to John 13 by first stopping at Philippians 2, then Romans 12, finally John 13. Look at Philippians 2, just a couple of verses. Verse 3, Paul writes, the New Living Translation reads, "Don't be selfish. Don't try to impress others. Be humble, thinking of others as better than yourselves. Don't look out only for your own interests, but take an interest in others too. When you do the Lord's work in the Lord's way, those are characteristics of your ministry." And we're all engaged in ministry in one way or another. If you know Christ, you're involved in ministry. You're involved in doing the Lord's work. You carry it out, whatever may be your career, your calling, your profession, whatever it may be. It is to be marked by an unselfishness. He writes, don't be selfish. It's to be characterized by not attempting to impress others. Don't try to impress others, makes it very clear. And third, it will be characterized by not looking out for your own interests only, but for the interests of others. That's what motivates us into action. That's what causes God's ministers to forget what time it is, what sacrifice may be involved, what the demand may require. Because we are God's servants, like Christ, we are to carry out his work his way. Romans 12 goes even deeper, and I'd like you to go there next. We often think of Romans as a great doctrinal book, and it certainly is that. But when you get to chapter 12, it becomes very earthy, very realistic, very practical. I'm looking at Romans 12, beginning at verse 7. So locate that. Again, from the New Living, if your gift is serving others, serve them well. If you're a teacher, teach well. If your gift is to encourage others, be encouraging. If it is giving, give generously. If God has given you leadership ability, take the responsibility seriously. If you have a gift of showing kindness to others, do it gladly. Don't just pretend to love others. Really love them. Hate what is wrong. Hold tightly to what is good. And he goes back again. Love each other with genuine affection. Take delight in honoring each other. When you do the Lord's work, the Lord's way, these are characteristics of how you carry that out. Continuing, verse 11, never be lazy, but work hard. Serve the Lord enthusiastically. Rejoice in our confident hope. Be patient in trouble and keep on praying. He continues, when God's people are in need, be ready to help. Always be eager to practice hospitality. Even goes further, bless those who persecute you. Why? Because that's what Jesus did. That's the Christ way. When you live for Christ, that's how you carry out your life. Don't curse them. That's what you do in the energy of the flesh. Pray that God will bless them. Be happy with those who are happy and weep with those who weep. Live in harmony with each other. Don't be too proud to enjoy the company of ordinary people. I love the way that reads. And back to Schaeffer's book, no small people. There are no little people or big people. We're all sheep. We're all just people. And when you're in ministry, you don't pay attention to how wealthy a person is or how little a person has or how old or how young or how clean or unkempt a person is. You look beyond all of those externals and you carry it out his way. Let me read Eugene Peterson's paraphrase from The Message. Listen to how he put it. Let's just go ahead and be what we're made to be without enviously or pridefully comparing ourselves with each other, trying to be something we aren't. If you preach, just preach God's message. Nothing else. If you help, just help. Don't take over. Be careful that you don't get bossy. If you're put in charge, don't manipulate. See, you manipulate when you operate in the energy of the flesh. Or you manipulate when you are doing it your way. You get bossy. You take over. It's important that you come out on top. But when you do it Christ's way, when you do it the Lord's work and the Lord's way, you don't do it like that. He goes on, love from the center of who you are. Don't fake it. Get along with each other. Don't be stuck up. Make friends with nobodies. Don't be the great somebody. You know, it's easy to come across as a believer as holier than thou, especially when you're in a group that's not holy. It's easy to come across as a know-it-all when you're in a gathering of people who don't know a lot and you know a lot. But when you do it God's way, like Christ did it, you don't find delight in doing that. In fact, you resist that. The Arizona Republic newspaper reported some time ago that a professor at the University of Arizona was speeding toward his class on the campus. He was late as his car flew past an unmarked Arizona Highway Patrol car. The officer pulled out, caught up with him, pulled him over, and approached the man behind the wheel. The professor explained that he was late for class. He was scheduled to teach at the university. And the policeman, in a rare moment, took pity on the professor, and he let him off with a warning. Before the cop walked away from the car, he said to the man, "Slow down and drive safe." Well, the professor felt the need to correct him. So he said, "Officer, excuse me, but you should have said, 'Slow down and drive safely.' You said, 'Drive safe.'" The officer told him to stay right there and give him his driver's license again. He went back to his car and wrote him a $72 speeding ticket. You know, we need to know when to shut our mouths. The guy's a jerk. He just had to show that he knew grammar. Don't correct people's grammar. Don't feel you have to correct every misstatement. Don't feel you have to set anyone straight. There'll be a time and a place when that could be appropriate, and when it's there, then in humility, you may be able to suggest some things that might help the individual. But when you operate like Christ, and when you do the work of God Christ's way, you do it with humility. It isn't a phony humility. Few things are worse than phony humility. It just stinks. But when it's real, it just disarms people, especially when they don't expect it. And whoever expected it from Christ? As magnificent as he was and as pristine as his past had been, if you could call his life past, since he's always existed. But having a record like no one else who has ever existed had, If there was anyone who had at least a semblance of reason to strut his stuff, it was he. But he didn't. He did not come to be served, but listen to this, he came to serve and to give. Two great verbs, two great actions, and throughout his life, you can check it, he's serving and he's giving. Now we're ready for John 13, turn there. It's a scene that has become familiar to all of us because it's the Last Supper. However, the familiarity may have bred a little oversight because there's so much here that is easy to miss. They've come together to celebrate the Passover meal. Jesus knew that his hour had come, verse 1 tells us, meaning the arrest and the trial were near, and his crucifixion was only one night away. Next day, he's nailed to a cross. He knows the hour has come. This is it. We're also told by John, who was there in the midst of the 12, that he loved them. Throughout his training of them, in fact, we read that he loved them, the end of verse 1 to the very end. You could render that to the end of their lives or to the end of his life. I think there's more to that than to the end would suggest. I think it means he loved them to the uttermost. We could say in slang of today, he loved them to the max. There was no condition in his love. He loved each one of them, each one of the 12. He loved them equally. He loved them deeply, consistently, sacrificially. He loved them all, and John, in writing this, as he looks back over the years, since John is the last of the gospel writers to write, he remembers, as he thinks back over those decades of time, he remembers this supper, and some things stand out. Now, something significant happened as they were at the table. Before I go further, let me explain the table. Tables in those days were low-lying tables. You ate reclining on the floor. You didn't sit in a chair. You literally were on your side. I thought about illustrating this, but I'd never get up. So I'll just lean over on an elbow and have you imagine that. They had pillows, they had cushions, and they rested on an elbow and they ate with their hands. There weren't utensils. They ate from the meal, the lamb, the charoshef, the dip, and on the meal went. So they're reclining at the table, and each person's body is alongside the back of the other one as they're reclining around the table. You get the picture? They're all reclining. They're all on the floor. We read, I don't want to go too fast here because I want you to get the picture in your mind. We read, literally, verse 2 says, during supper, literally as supper was taking place. So he's not finished with his meal, nor are they. They're in the midst of talk and all that goes with that, as you do at a meal. And what do we read? Verse 4, he got up from the table. Literally, he rose out from the supper. So he pushed back, he slid back from the table. He pushed up with his arm, and he stood up straight. He rose up. They're all reclining. They had no idea what he was doing, what he needed to do. Maybe he was going to get water. Maybe he was going to step aside for a few moments. But he just rose up, didn't say anything. He got up from supper. Now, when I read that, I ask why. Don't you do that? Why did he do that? And why then? Why during the meal? In fact, we read that when he stood up, he disrobed, took off his outer robe, got a towel that was over by the basin, and he wrapped himself in the towel so he'd have it handy, had a pitcher with water in it, got a large bowl called here a basin, poured the water in the bowl, and then he stooped down, and we read, he began to wash the disciples' feet, drying them with the towel he had around them. Verse 5. Not a word. Why did he do that? Why then? I think it's because of something that he heard and because of something that he saw. John mentions neither one. Luke mentions what he heard. The implication I'll give to you in a moment, which explains what he saw. Luke tells us what he heard. According to Luke 22:24, listen to this. While they were at the table, they were arguing among themselves about who would be greatest among them. Did you know that? Has anyone ever told you that? I had never had anyone tell me that. So at the table, there was an argument that broke out among the 12 as to which one would be the greatest. He heard that. He heard the arguing, which stemmed from their pride. You argue over those things when you're proud of yourself or you're comparing yourself with others, which again is an act of pride, especially when your motive is to come out the greatest. And what did he see? Well, he saw that their feet were dirty. Now, what's so unusual about that? Well, they should have been clean. Let me explain. This is back in the day before there were paved roads and before the trails had hard surface. In dry weather, the dust and the dirt on the road and the trails would be ankle deep. And because you wore sandals, no socks, your feet would really get filthy. It was the common thing then, and still it's common when you are in the Far East, to kick off your sandals when you come to the door. And what normally done, the host at the banquet or the meal that's being served would provide a servant at the door who would then wash your feet before you went inside the house so that you would go in with clean feet. Now, if there was no servant on duty, as certainly there wasn't, since this is no special banquet. This is a meal among friends. 13 of these people are getting together. So in those cases, the gracious thing to do and the humble thing to do is that one person would appoint himself as the servant at the entrance door and would stoop as people came in. Sandals are kicked off, and he would wash each of their feet and then his before he would come in, all coming in with clean feet. But they have all come in with dirty feet. It's interesting to me that they were ready to occupy a throne with authority, but nobody wrestled over the towel to serve anyone else. I want to stop here and offer four let's call them principles for ministry that have to do with humility. They're all seen in what transpires. First, humility is unannounced. It's unannounced. As soon as humility is announced, it's pride. You're showing off. But Jesus stood up and without a word prepared himself to wash their feet. He didn't stand up and say, I am now going to illustrate a lesson you need to learn. You will witness humility in action. He doesn't do that. It even sounds stupid to say that. He stands up, not a word. And prepares himself to wash their feet. Before I go on, during this lengthy COVID-19 valley we've walked through, a lot of emphasis has been placed on those who are at risk. I'll get to that in just a moment. But keep that in mind because it ties in with the second principle that humility is being willing to receive without embarrassment or resentment. See, no word was said. I think some of them kept arguing, then realized their feet were being washed and probably toned down. But when he got to Peter, all of a sudden there was a mild explosion. Look at verse 6. When Jesus came to Simon Peter, he said, Lord, my feet you're going to wash? The way it's written in the original puts the pronouns together and when they're in juxtapositions for the purpose of contrast. You, my feet, are going to wash? Now, I don't want to read more into it than is here, but I really think that was a statement of embarrassed pride. He wanted to come across as humility. It could have sounded like it, but the resistance kept it from being humble. In fact, it leads to his response. Jesus said, you don't understand what I'm doing. Someday you will. And Peter protested, no. Stop. Don't touch my feet. I can wash my own feet. You can see him tucking his feet on. It's so like Peter. But before I bang around on Peter, I have to confess to all of you that being in the middle of the virus, you learn that those who have compromised immune system have to be very, very careful. Those who are showing symptoms certainly need to be, and those who are getting up in years. Okay? I read about that, and I thought about all the people that are getting up in years, and I thought how difficult it must be for them. And then our daughter came along, our older daughter who lives two doors down, and said, Mom and Dad, I don't want you shopping, and I don't want you going out. And even though you wear a mask and gloves and think you're going to, you know, you're bulletproof, I'm going to take care of shopping for you. And, you know, my first thought was, I can shop for myself. I'm able to do this. It wasn't a matter of I couldn't do it for myself. It was a matter of I shouldn't. In fact, this is the time when Peter shouldn't resist. His feet are dirty. And let's face it, I'm old. And my daughter is helping to watch out for us. One of the reasons we're still, well, so Cynthia. She's old. Maybe older. She's a little older, not older than I am. Few people on earth are older than I am, but she's getting up in a few years, and so we're both vulnerable. We ought not be out there running around picking up lettuces and celery and, butter and sauces and all that. We ought to let our daughter do it for us. It's the hardest thing in the world when you're type A to let other people do that for you. It's a check on your pride. I say to my own embarrassment. But we've learned to let her do it, usually. We usually do that. But I told you there's kind of a reverse roles. When she was the teenager, we had to watch out because she'd sneak out and do, do things. Now we're sneaking out. And I say to Cynthia, you watch out. See if Carissa's watching. I'll be right back. And yes, she's watching, and she's back, and she's there to talk to me. And so I understand this. I'm not beating up on Peter. I've got the same problem, and maybe you do too. But look at Jesus' response. In fact, don't miss the principle. Humility is being willing to receive without embarrassment or resistance. That's humility. You know, it occurs to me, if you're a caregiver, it also takes humility to be a care receiver. The caregiver is doing a lot of very private, personal things. It's kind of tough for you to let happen, but you can't do it yourself. It takes humility to let someone really serve you. Peter wasn't about to do that. So it's easier for me to talk about Peter than me. So forget the other stuff and look back at Peter. Peter says, no, you'll never wash my feet. In fact, the way it reads in the original, you will not wash my feet unto the ages, into eternity. And Jesus' response, look, he says to him, unless I wash you, it's over, Peter. This is where we part ways. Unless I wash you, you don't belong to me. Look at that. You know what the principle is? Humility is not a sign of weakness. When you do the Lord's work in the Lord's way, you're not a wimp. You're not a spineless nobody that people walk all over. Are you kidding? You're among the strongest on the planet. Jesus stands up to him and he says, you listen to me, Peter. This is where we part ways. Put your feet out here. I'm going to wash your feet. Because they are dirty. And Peter, it was so like Peter, blurts out, not my feet only, but my hands and my head. Give me a whole bath. And Jesus says, oh, you don't need a bath. You're okay all over, but your feet are dirty. But not all of you are clean. At the time, you could have thought, it's a little throwaway line, meaning your feet are dirty, but the rest of you is clean. So let me take care of your feet. But he meant more than that. Remember, John's had 60 years to think back over the event. So John says, Jesus knew who would betray him. That's what he meant when he said, not all of you are clean. That's a little insert that John places here, thanks to the time, the lapse, when he's been able to see it all, and now he knew Judas was the one. Speaking of that, verse 12, after washing their feet, all 12 pairs of feet, including Judas. I pause because I want that to sink in. The principle is obvious. Humility doesn't play favorites. And the easiest thing in the world in ministry is to have favorites. Some people are just really easy to love. They're just a pastor's delight, or they're a teacher's friend. They're on the edge of their seat. They're there to help. They'll do anything for you. They're thoughtful. They care. They're responsive. And then there are Judases. There are Alexander the Coppersmiths. There are Diotrephes. There are Demases. There are people that are tough to really enjoy being with and to serve. But you serve them all. Now, you have to be careful here, because the tendency when you get to someone like Judas is to heat up the water. Okay? Or to maybe get it when it's really ice cold. Ideally, dry clean them. Take the hide off. But he doesn't do that. Just as tenderly as he used the towel to dry Andrew's feet and Matthew's feet and Peter's feet, he dried Judas's feet. I wonder if he looked at him. Just looked at him. Now, I love this. This is where I almost go to tears when I get to the end of this because of the way he handles it. When he finishes, after washing their feet, he put on his robe again and sat down. So he reclines at the table again. And he asked them, do you understand what I was doing? You get it? Here it is. You get the message? They're silent. There's no answer. They're thinking, just like you are. I mean, the obvious thing is you washed our feet. That's not what Jesus doesn't ask questions that have obvious answers. They're questions that make you think. This one especially. Do you understand what I did? Not did you see what I've done, but do you understand it? You get it. You call me teacher and Lord. You're right. Am I the teacher and Lord? Right, you certainly are, Lord. Because that's what I am. That's my role. And you acknowledge that. And since I, your Lord and teacher, have washed your feet. Now, what do you expect? I know you've read ahead, so you know what he says. But let's act like you haven't. Wouldn't you expect him to say, now you wash my feet? Wouldn't that seem to be the most obvious? I've washed yours, now please wash mine. But he doesn't say that. Who wouldn't wash Jesus' feet? We stand in line to wash his feet. It's an honor to wash Jesus' feet. We would do anything for him. They especially now. But he says, he turns it on his head and says, I've done this so you will know. This is what you need to do with one another. Verse 17, now that you know these things, God will bless you for doing them. Two final lessons, and then I'm going to read your story. Lesson number one, ministering in humility means serving everyone, not just the Lord. We're not in our work to serve the Lord only. We're in the work to serve one another. It's the genius of wash one another's feet. So as we minister, let's keep in mind there are others in the family, and there are many out of the family. Many we come across, many we meet along life's way. Serving the Lord is always an honor. Serving others is an act of humility. Which is the second lesson here. God blesses those who demonstrate humility, not those who just know about it. See how he says it in verse 17? You're blessed if you do these things. You see what I've done. You're blessed if you do them. Right now, you've heard about it, and you've seen it. Time to do it. I love the words of Jesus. They always put a catch in my throat. To the extent that you have done this to one of these brothers of mine, even the least of them, you've done it to me. When you do his work, his way to the least, your rewards will be many. Teddy Stallard certainly qualified as one of the least. Disinterested in school, musty, wrinkled clothing, hair never combed. One of those kids in school with a deadpan face, expressionless, sort of a glassy, unfocused stare. When Miss Thompson spoke to Teddy, he answered in monosyllables. Unattractive, unmotivated, and distant. He was just plain hard to like. Even though his teacher said she loved all of her class the same, down deep inside, she wasn't being completely truthful. Whenever she marked Teddy's papers, she got a certain perverse pleasure out of putting a big X next to the wrong answers. And when she wrote an F at the top of the paper, she always did so with a flair. She should have known better. She had Teddy's records, and she knew more about him than she wanted to admit. The records read, first grade, Teddy shows promise with his work and attitude, but has a poor home situation. Second grade, Teddy could do better. Mother is seriously ill, receives little help at home. Third grade, Teddy's a good boy, but he's too serious. He's a slow learner. Mother died this year. Fourth grade. Teddy is very slow, but he's well behaved. Father shows no interest in him. Christmas came, and the boys and girls in Miss Thompson's class brought her Christmas presents. They piled their presents high on her desk, crowded around to watch her open them. Among the presents, there was one from Teddy Stallard. She was surprised that he had brought her a gift, but he had. Teddy's gift was wrapped in brown paper and was held together with a lot of scotch tape. On the paper were written simple words for Miss Thompson from Teddy Stallard. When she opened Teddy's present, out fell a gaudy rhinestone bracelet, half the stones missing, and a bottle of cheap perfume. The other boys and girls began to giggle and smirk over Teddy's gifts, but Miss Thompson at least had enough presence of mind to put them on immediately. She put on the bracelet and then splashed some perfume on her wrist, holding her wrist up for others to smell and see. She said, doesn't it smell lovely? The children, taking their cue from their teacher, readily agreed with oohs and ahs. At the end of the day, when school was over and the other children left, Teddy lingered. He slowly walked up to her desk and said softly, Miss Thompson, you smell just like my mother. And her bracelet looks really pretty on you. So glad you like my presents. When Teddy left, Miss Thompson dropped to her knees and asked God to forgive her. The next day, when the children returned to school, they were welcomed by a brand new Miss Thompson. She had become a different person. She was no longer just a teacher. She had become an agent of God. She was now a person committed to loving her children and doing things for them that would live on after her. And she made sure she did that for all of them. She helped all the children, but especially the slow ones, especially Teddy Stallard. By the end of that school year, Teddy showed dramatic improvement. He had caught up with most of the students and was even ahead of a few. She didn't hear from Teddy for a long time, and then one day, years later, she received a note that read, "Dear Miss Thompson, I wanted you to be the first to know I'll be graduating second in my class. Love, Teddy Stallard." 4 years later, another note came to her desk. "Dear Miss Thompson, they just told me I'll be graduating first in my class. I want you to be the first to know the university has been difficult, but I like the study. Love, Teddy Stallard." And 4 years later, "Dear Miss Thompson, as of today, I am Theodore Stallard, MD. How about that? I wanted you to be the first to know I'm getting married next month, the 27th to be exact. I would like for you to come and sit where my mother would sit if she were alive. You're the only family I have now. Dad died last year. Love, Teddy Stallard." Miss Thompson went to the wedding and sat where Teddy's mother would have sat. She deserved to sit there. She had done something for Teddy he could never forget. Please, please listen to me. We must do God's work God's way. For the rest of our lives, long after the virus is just a memory, let's use this as the time when we turn the corner and we became agents of God for those who need us the most, even the least of them. Please. Bow with me, please. Thank you, Father, for the Miss Thompsons in our lives. Thank you that their words burn deeper in our minds today than even our parents' words. Thank you that their actions are so vivid, it's as if they happened yesterday. Thank you that you prompted them to love us, even when we weren't very lovely. Now teach us, Lord, teach us to be like your Son, to do your work his way. In Jesus' name, amen.